We are in chapter 3, and specifically, we're going to start with sentence, let's go with sentence 23. Oh, now we're all using the cards instead of using the cards. 1783, thank you. From my perspective, yes.
Not bad in America.
Exactly. Okay. So, remember that the last thing we had read was that Daniel's three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, have been bound up in their cloaks for the crime of not bowing to the statue when the music played, and then of a little bit of chutzpah then when questioned, when they were asked about this. Let's actually go back to Chafet, sentence 22, chapter 3, sentence 22. That's right after they are bound up. Kol kavel dina, at this point, min dimilas malka machtsifa ve'atuna eze yetira. From the strength, there's that word, chutzpah, swiftness or strength, of the king's order. And from the fact that the oven, the atuna, is the oven, was very strong, it had really been fired up, Guvraya ilech dihasiku l'shadrach meshach v'avednego, these men who had put the three men into the fire, katil himon shviva di nura. They themselves were killed by a flame that came out of the oven. In other words, they opened the door. They always warn you, if you're boiling something on the stove, and the lid is on it, you're going to take off the lid, right? You pick off the lid away from you, because that allows the steam to escape there. So they didn't have that option when they opened up the oven to throw these three men in. The fuel has been added. The oven is very, very hot. And lo and behold, a tongue of flame comes out of the oven and burns the men who had thrown him in. This table is fine to use. This table is available. So that's how hot the oven is. The Guvraya Ilech Tlateon and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, Ba'avednego, Nefalu Lego Atun, Nura Yakirta Mechafsin, and the three of them fall into the oven while bound up. Well, we can only imagine what's going to happen next, right? Presumably, if it's hot enough, there's such a strong flame that you open the door and a flame comes shooting out, then there isn't any hope for them. I would have expected. Sorry? Really? Well, let's see what happens. Oh my. Well, Edayin Nebuchadnezzar Malka Tevava come behisbehala. At that point, remember Edayin Az? At that point, King Nebuchadnezzar is shocked and he rises in haste and confusion, hit behala, like behala in Hebrew. He's confused. Anevi amar lahadavrohi. He declared to those who spoke to him, his counselors, halaguvrin talasa remena lego nura mechapsin. Didn't you throw three men bound up into the fire? And anayin va'amrin the malka yativa malka. And they responded, they declared to the king, yeah, that's true, we threw in three men, yes. Aneva Omar, so he responded and he declared and he said, Ha na chaze guvrin arba'a. He said, guess what? I see four men, shrayin mahlechin begonura. And they are shrayin. Shrayin is untied. The word in Aramaic for mutar is shari. Mutar literally we use to mean what? In Hebrew, permitted. But really, mutar means untied. Like matir asurim doesn't mean one who permits that which is prohibited. Matir asurim means the one who releases those who have been bound up. So mutar is untied, and in an Aramaic, shari then doesn't just mean permitted, it means untied. So I see four men untied, malachin begonura, walking among the flames. V'chaval la'isai ba'on, and there is not a mark on them. Vareve di revi'a'a dame lebar Elohim. And the appearance of the fourth is like an angelic being. Well, that's remarkable, I think.
That could be God who was in there, or an angel that he sent to.
Well, here's the funny thing that happens. I'm going to jump to sentence 26 here, even though we're not really ready for it. Because you have to read sentence 26 in order to try to break down sentence 25. Beidayin, at that point, us, Krev Nebuchadnezzar Lisra Atun Nura Yakidita. Nebuchadnezzar drew close to the entrance of this fiery furnace. And again, you know, Sharon had asked the question before, how did he see into the oven in the first place? My only thought is that they opened it to check and see what was going on. That's the logic I can offer. So Aneva Amar, he declared and he said, Shadrach Meshach Vavednego, Avdoi di Eloka Ilah, Shadrach Meshach and Avednego, servants of the high God, the highest God, Puku Veso, come on out. And at that point, then the three of them indeed came out from within the flames. What's missing in that sentence? Where's number four? He didn't call number four to come out, and number four didn't come out. And not only that, number four is not going to show up in the rest of the chapter or the book. So what's with this fourth man who isn't coming out of the oven? What in the world is going on here in this oven? So you could suggest that angel, God, we could suggest whatever we like, and we're going to have to go through different views. Shana,
I was going to say, how does Nebuchadnezzar know what an angel looks like?
Who says he does?
Well, he says it looks like an angel.
Oh, that's true, actually. I'm sorry. Hang in there. No, hang in there, or you can take a look at source number three, whichever one you like. I thought you were asking me a different question. It took me a second to process that.
It could have been Daniel.
Oh, could have been Daniel? Could be. We can give all sorts of interesting ideas, but...
Well,
but
they would say Daniel came
out. No, they wouldn't say it.
No?
They've got to keep the mystery going.
Well, the mystery is going to keep on going, because the book's not going to solve it. So take a look at source number one. We get one suggestion. Passage out of the Talmud describes a fascinating debate that goes on at this moment. Bishah sheipil Nebuchadnezzar harasha Hananya Mishah v'Azariah toch kivshana eish. Wicked Nebuchadnezzar cast the three of them into the fire. Amar Yorkamu sar habarad lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yorkamu, not a name that people use to give their kids these days. One wonders, why not? Yorkamu, the agent of hail, who I understand is visiting us this evening potentially, stood up before God, Amar Lefanov, and said, Ribono Shalola, master of the universe, Ered va'atzaneinez ha'kivshan, I will descend and cool off this furnace, va'atzil etzadikim halala mikivshan ha'esh, and I will save the righteous from the fiery furnace. I got it covered, God, don't you worry. Now, remember the concept, in general, of angels that are in charge of, there's a sheet here, angels that are in charge of natural phenomena. This is an idea that we have going back to earliest times, that that even though God is fully capable of running the show, doing everything personally, anything that God uses to carry out a task gains the title of malach, which is the Hebrew term that we associate with the Greek term, you know, angel, the Greek base term. But the word malach, it does not have the connotations of angel, spiritual being, and so on. The word malach, mem lamed aleph chaf, comes from the word melacha, which is a task. One who is appointed to carry out a task is a malach, so that within the Torah itself, you will find human beings who are called malach. Rambam suggests you will have inanimate objects that are called malach as well. So that this yorkamu is whatever force it is that causes hail, and it is summoned by the need to save these righteous people from the fire. It says, I have to go and I have to cool off the fire. This is how we're going to save Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah.
But why is it that it seems backwards to me that the malach is that what you call it?
Yeah.
Is telling God
Yeah.
Other than God telling Amala to save his...
Right. So the question is, how far do we take the allegory? In other words, it sounds like we're identifying Yorkamu as an independent being with volition who's going to recommend to God, you know, now might be a good time for me to get involved. The weakness in that, aside from the fact that you're now then, you know, really outsourcing saving Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, and acting as though it's not really God's priority, is also the passage of time. Like, at what point does this conversation actually take place? They're being thrown into the furnace, which it should be burning them instantaneously. So what's the timetable for this even? So that it could be understood that this is along the lines of what we see at various times within the Gemara, an anthropomorphization of a divine trait. So that the Talmud will say the attribute of justice spoke out before God, or the attribute of mercy said before God, even though those are God's own attributes, and it's playing out in a conversation what's going on, so to speak, in God's head, you know, as it were. That could be what's going on here, is that, in fact, this is God's conversation with himself, so to speak. It's certainly within the pale of a proper read on this Talmudic account. But look what happens. Yorkamu wants to cool off the fire. Gavriel said to him, God's might is not thus. You are the agent of hail. And all know that water extinguishes fire. That wouldn't be so impressive. If hail came along and cooled off the furnace, everyone would say, oh, so there was a sudden hailstorm. That happens in the palace. I, on the other hand, he says, I am the agent of fire. Ani sar shel esh. Ered v'akarer mi bifnim v'akdiach mi bachutz. I am going to cool it off on the inside while heating it up on the outside. V'asen neis betoch neis. I will make a miracle within a miracle. So that it'll be really hot on the outside, they're going to be fine on the inside, and therefore the person, according to this passage in the Talmud, the fourth being who's in the fire, is the angel Gabriel. That's the way that the Talmud renders this. Now, that's not the only take. I mean, that in of itself is fascinating, and there's a nice long discussion in the commentaries as to what exactly this means. What is a greater miracle? What is a lesser miracle? Showing divine might. And that's we could spend the whole class on that, but I wanted to keep it close to the text. Others have taken this in different ways.
Explains four, but if you read this and take that into consideration, then there should be five.
No, Yorkamu doesn't get to go. No, this is just Gabriel. Yorkamu doesn't make it. Abarbanel notes that the Christian commentators took this as their savior, coming into the furnace in order to save Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He himself, surprised, rejects this. But he doesn't reject it on the grounds of, come on, you're silly, we don't believe in that. He rejects it on logical grounds. He actually has, he brings logical arguments. He says, within your perspective that God would himself manifest in physical form on earth, that wouldn't happen for another 500 years. That's number one. Number two, you don't need God himself going into the furnace to do this. God has agents to do things like this. He wouldn't need to. And he says, the text itself indicates that this is some kind of an emissary of God with his description of his appearance being like a bar Elohim, which is a term we usually use for malach, although you could translate it as son of God, which clearly is what they did. But he says, it doesn't fit, even within your view, within your Christian outlook, this doesn't make any sense for you to make this identification. That's what Abarbanel says. But, he says, I'll tell you what I think, and he proceeds to say something that classic Abarbanel is not at all what anybody else would ever say. He says, indeed, that it was Daniel, but it wasn't Daniel. It was Nebuchadnezzar conceiving of the merit of Daniel saving them in the flames. He didn't really see a fourth man at all. There was no fourth man. Because if I were to take the Talmudic account that he saw the angel Gabriel there in the furnace, then he would have called. All four of you come out. Right? Come out, whoever you are. He didn't call for the fourth to come out. Rather, it was a phrase. It's not an idiom. But he was speaking as though there was a fourth there. He didn't really mean there was a fourth. What he meant was, I see the three of them doing just fine in the merit of a fourth, who is Daniel. If you take a look on your sheet, well, you'll see the wording in source number 2. Ve'efshar od etzli, it is also possible to me, he says, and Barbanel does that frequently, where he'll present other views, and then he'll say it's also possible to say, and that's the one he really believes is right, and that's the one he'll proceed. From there on out, he will proceed as though he hadn't even suggested other ideas. So he says, Ve'efshar od etzli, it's also possible to me, she'agever haravi'i she'zachar Nebuchadnezzar she'ra'ah, that the fourth man Nebuchadnezzar mentioned that he had seen, Lo amro kim al Daniel. He was speaking only about Daniel. Ba'avur shahayu arba'atam chaverim, because the four of them were peers, they were colleagues. V'ra'ah ha'nez shenasa l'shloshah mehem. He saw the miracle that had been done for the three of them. V'chashav shahayu bizchut Daniel, and he thought it was in Daniel's merit. Dot, dot, dot. She'inei kasher kara Nebuchadnezzar lem she'izu min ha'esh lo kara kim l'shloshah, kim l'shloshah. When he called for them to leave the fire, he only called three. Meaning, Nebuchadnezzar did not see a fourth person in the fire. What he was saying was, I see that they are fine in the merit of a fourth. Now this fits the way that we've seen Nebuchadnezzar treat Daniel. Remember that after Daniel explained the dream, he treated Daniel as a quasi-god. And it fits with what we saw last week when Nebuchadnezzar said, I better hurry, within Abarbanel's perspective, I better hurry this before Daniel finds out and intervenes. So he rushed to do it, but he says, oh, too late. Daniel got involved. That must be why they're okay. You follow? That's Abarbanel's picture of what is happening. Now, Shana asked a question. Which was, how does Nebuchadnezzar know what an angel looks like in the first place? So take a look at source number 3, in which Rashi condenses for us a passage in the Talmud. Domele malach, he appears like an angel. Shera'isi b'hiyosi im Sancherev kishenisrefu uchlusav, which I saw when Sancherev's forces were burned. Because Nebuchadnezzar hayasham v'nimlat v'tocha sarashnim l'tumehem, when Sancherev attacks, Sancherev is significantly before Nebuchadnezzar, but the Assyrian Empire under Sancherev invades Israel and exiles the 10 northern tribes. They attack Jerusalem, they are driven back by an angelic force, and only 10 survive. So the Talmud suggests Nebuchadnezzar was there at that time. And he was a witness, and that's how he knew what an angel would look like. Frankly, to me, it's a lot easier to just say, and I think Barbanel would be very comfortable saying, is what he imagines an angel would look like, because the whole thing is his imagination. He's imagining a fourth being in the fire anyway. So he says, yeah, an angelic being. Who's going to tell him he's wrong? That's not what angels look like after all. But the Talmud does suggest that that's how he knew. This is part of a greater picture within the way the Talmud works when it looks at Tanakh. We've discussed it on other occasions, the law of conservation of biblical personalities. Right? When we talked about Daniel potentially being Hatach from Megillat Esther. Right? Points for all those who identified him in the Megillah. Right? There were a couple of different associations between the book of Daniel and Megillat Esther, but that was one of them. But we said then, there is this trend to sort of blend together personalities, and maybe Mordechai was also Ezra, who was also this one, and we link together various people. We also link together various events. So that, for example, the discussion of how Achashverosh got to power, you know, blends together the Babylonian Empire with the Persian and Mede Empire that supplanted and carry one right into the next. So this could be also a blending sort of from the Assyrian Empire into the Babylonian by having Nebuchadnezzar there at the battlefield when the Assyrians were driven back. There's more to be said on that as an idea. But in any case, that's one suggestion for how he knew what an angel would look like. So Nebuchadnezzar calls out and says, come on out of the oven. We read that in chapter 3, sentence 26. I'm going to come back to the oven. We're not done with the oven yet, but I want to finish the story first. Sentence 27. Umiskanshin achash dar panaya signaya upachvasa va'adavre malka. All of these different officials of various kinds gather. Chazayin leguvraya ileich. They see these men. Dilashleit nura begeshmahon. That fire had not had any power over their physical form. Usar reishon lahischarach. The hair on their heads were not singed. Was not singed. Right? That's where you got the phrase. Right? Not a hair on their head? That's where it comes from. Visar b'leon alar. I think so, anyway. Visar b'leon lashino. There was no effect on their clothing, even, of this experience. Remember, we talked about how they were bound up in their royal garb. It was untouched. Vereach nur la'adas b'leon. And not even the smell of fire was upon them. Ane Nebuchadnezzar ba'omer. So Nebuchadnezzar declared and said, out of this, Brich elakahon di Shadrach Meshach va'Abednego. Blessed is the God of Shadrach Meshach va'Abednego, di Shalach Malache v'Sheziv la'Avdohi, who sent his Malach. There's that image of not as a god, but as a servant of God, and saved his servants. The Hisrechitzu Alohi, who depended upon him, who trusted in him. Umilas Malka Shaniu, they changed literally the word of the king, right? They did not obey the word of, well, frankly, my word. They didn't listen to me in what I told and what I said they should do. Vihavu Gesh Mahon, they gave their bodies, Dilayiflachun Vla Yiskidun Lachola Lakala Hain Le Lakahon Lachola Law Lahain Le Lakahon. They gave their bodies, saying they would not serve any god other than their god. So here you have Nebuchadnezzar's second repentance, if you will. His first one was when Daniel interpreted the dream, and he talked about how amazing the God of the Jews is. His second is now here, when he again speaks to the amazing character of this God. This is Nebuchadnezzar, destroyer of the temple. And he concludes sentence 29, Umini sim te'em di kol am uma valishan di yemar shalo al alakahon di shadrach meshach va'abednego. He says, I am giving orders that any nation, anyone who says anything bad about the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hadam and Yisaved is going to be cut up into tiny pieces. He may have repented, but he still retained his barbaric character. The Ubaisei Nevali Yishtavei, and his house will be converted to ruins. Kol Kavel Dila Isai Alaka Acharan Di Kulat Zola Kidina, because there's no God who can save like their God does. Hukoi needs me to cut people into tiny pieces, therefore. Beidayin Malka Haslach L'Shadrach Meshach V'Abednego B'Medinas Bavel. And so God makes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego successful in the land of Bavel. Exit stage left. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You will not see them again in this book. I'm going to come back to that.
What does he mean makes them successful? In what way?
So we don't actually know. We just know that he gave them power of some kind or some success. But hold on to the question, because I want to talk about what happened to them. But before we get to that... Oh, yes. In a very big way. He was gone for this story.
Yeah.
Right? That was that whole discussion about where is he. But take a look at source number 4. Bishah Sheh, this is the Talmud speaking now. Bishah Sheh Pil Nebuchadnezzar Harasha Eschananya Mishah Vazariah Lekivshana Eish. When Nebuchadnezzar, wicked Nebuchadnezzar, cast the three of them into the furnace. God said to Yechezkel, in case you were wondering where Yechezkel was, Yechezkel is the prophet who speaks to the Jews when they are in exile in Babylon. He is around in the beginning of their exile when this is supposed to be taking place. So why does he not figure in this? Oh, we have an association. What happened? God said to Yechezkel, Lech v'achaye meisim bebikas Dura, go revive the dead in the valley of Dura. That's what you're supposed to do. We have a prophecy in which he brings the dry bones back to life. So that is what's happening at this point. Kevin Shechia Osun, once he did that, Bo Atsamos Vitaf Chulola Osa Rasha Alpanav. The bones came and they slapped that wicked person in the face. Omar Mativan Shalelu. He said, what is this? Isn't that what you would say? Amrulo, to which they replied, Chavrei and Shalelu Mechaye Mason Bebik Azdura. You should know, those three people you just threw in the furnace, their colleague is off reviving the dead. Pasach va'omer, and at that point he opened up and he said verses that we haven't yet seen in sentences 31 to 33, the end of this chapter. We're going to come to them, but he declares, "Asoi kama ravervin v'timhoi kama tekifin. How great are God's deeds! How mighty are His wonders! Malchusei malchus alam. His kingdom is forever. V'shaltanei imdor vador. His reign is from generation to generation." Which is the verse that we haven't yet gotten to. There's a problem with the next three verses in this chapter. The problem is it's not clear whether they are a postscript to this story or preface the beginning of the next story. It appears clear to me as I read it that it's actually the beginning of the next story. Remember that we are not the ones who made the chapter breaks. So this was imposed on us. But fascinatingly, in the King James Version, they actually take the next three verses and have them as the opening sentences of chapter 4. So if you were to look at a King James version of Daniel, you would actually be thrown off in terms of the verse numbers in chapter 4, because they have three more verses in the beginning that we have at the end of chapter 3. So this passage in the Talmud here is trying to sort of explain what those three verses are doing there by saying it's a postscript to this event. Right? It's right after. The Talmud doesn't have the chapter breaks at all, so for them it's not a problem. They don't have chapter breaks in general. But they're reading it as a result of him witnessing this revival of the dead. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak comes along and he says, Yitzchak Zahav Roteach Letoch Piv Shel Oto Rasha. Molten gold should be poured into the mouth of that wicked person. Had a malach not come and slapped him, he would have put to shame all of the songs and praises that King David offered in Tehillim. And the praises are what he says here. Again, could be from chapter 3, could be from what's going to happen in chapter 4. That's unclear. But what do you see in the image of pouring molten gold? What does that image mean? Well, it's a painful death, yes. What else? Right, he's very into this gold, right? We saw the golden statue, right? So there could be an association there. What else? It's sort of, I think, it's like killing him in a royal way. You know? Yes, he's going to die, but it's with gold. We're going to kill him with gold. Yeah? Because he speaks such glorious praise of God. He's not entitled to do that. We're going to put a stop to this, but with gold. Why is he not entitled? Because he's the destroyer of the temple. How, by what right does he offer these great praises of God? He destroyed the temple. He killed thousands upon thousands of Jews. He exiled us from our land. You know, we still haven't recovered from that to this day. So, by what right does he get to offer such wondrous praise of God? And then he continues. I skipped a little bit. But then, Amar Abitanachum Bar Chani Lai, still in source 4, when these three men came out of the fire, the nations came and they slapped the, quote, enemies of Israel. It means us. It doesn't mean enemies. It's a euphemism. He slapped Israel themselves, slapped the Jews in the face. Amrulam saying to them, you have a God like this. And you're bowing to a statue? Which leads to the pasuk that we'll see later in Daniel. God, you are righteous, and we are ashamed. Which we'll get to. I didn't put it in the English translation, just in the interest of space. But that's the that's the statement, is that they, Nebuchadnezzar and the nations are so impressed by all of this. So what happened to Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, and why don't they show up for the rest of the book? Well, the Talmud offers three different options, and then we'll see a Barbanel characteristically with a fourth. Take a look at source number five. Lehechan Azlu, where did they go? Omar Rav, Rav says, Ba'ayin Hara Mesu. They died of the evil eye. Evil eye. What is an evil eye? A curse? We could do better than that. What is an evil eye? In Tanakh, what is an evil eye? Jealousy, sometimes. It's fundamentally an eye that looks negatively upon somebody else. Whether that's out of jealousy, out of a feeling of they don't deserve what they have, I don't want to give them, right? For example, v'ra'a incha b'achicha ha'evyon. If your eye is evil against your brother the pauper, saying you are not going to lend him money before the Shemitah year, that's one usage in the Torah. There are many. Last year we had that class, the melting class, so Shane is being quiet because she was there. She knows all this. But the ayin ra is when you judge somebody else in a negative way. And the ayin ra here could be jealousy, like look at them. And then others end up attacking them, undermining them, or saying to God, they don't deserve what they have. God, you should punish them because you did this amazing miracle. They don't deserve that they should have this. So that's one explanation. But that's not the only one. Ushmuel amar berok tavu. Shmuel says they drowned in saliva, which is gross. Rashi says what it means is what we saw in the previous source, where the nations say, you have a God like this, and yet you bow to idols. The nations so despised the Jews in exile among them for their sins. So it's as though they drowned in saliva. And then the third approach, more benign, Rabbi Yochanan Amar Alu L'Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yochanan says they made Aliyah. They went to Israel. V'nasu Nashim, they got married. V'lidu Banim U'Banos, and they had children. Why? How do you get that? Shneamar, because look at the sentence in Zechariah. Shmana Yoshua Kohen Agadol Atav Re'echa Yoshvim Lefanecha Kian Shemo Face Hema. The pasuk towards the beginning of Zechariah, addressed to Joshua the high priest, saying, you and your friends who are before you, who are men of miracles. In Zechariah, it's not at all clear who the men of miracles would be. We don't have miracles being performed for people in Zechariah. We don't get stories like that there. We get a lot of dreams, a lot of visions, but there isn't a whole lot of action. So what is it that, who are the people of miracles? Says the Talmud, it's Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They're now in Israel. And that's where they went. So we have three different suggestions here. And a fourth. Don Isaac of Barbanel. Source number six, the Hebrew's on one side of the page, the English is over on the flip side. He says, this was it. This was their part in the play. Exit stage left. The Tachlis Mashahaya in Yanam, Haya Zane Shinasalahem, their role in the book was this miracle that happened to them. Therefore, they are not mentioned anywhere else in this book. Rashum Uba, and Tamid Zichronam Nigrar Achar Daniel. Their mention is always drawn after Daniel, Ubesi Baso, and it's because of him, Lomi Pa'asatzmam, not for their sake. Yeah, they're good people. They did this amazing thing that they refused to bow, and they went into the furnace for it. But they're not going to show up elsewhere in the book. That's not who they are. Yeah. Purpose served, and we don't really need to record it now in the book. It doesn't. Remember that, you know, Barbanel is very big in general on this, but just to realize, all the books that we have of the prophets are, to a certain extent, and we don't know the extent, redacted for the great assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, who decide what's in and what's out. They make their decision. So much so that Talmud has a whole discussion where they wanted to know, should we include Ecclesiastes? There's an awful lot of strange material in there. Do we include the Song of Songs? It looks like a love story. Do we include Mishlei? It looks like it's a book of wisdom. Like, there's a lot of debate as to what to include and what not to include. And so it's entirely possible, and Abarbanel is very into various times asking, so why did they include this? Why didn't they include that? What's the goal of this book? It could be that there were other stories that were known about them, but the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah said, we don't really need that here. It's not necessary for this book. So therefore, we're not going to include them. Okay. But this story, for all the fact that it's the only one in which Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah play a starring role, has had a huge impact in Jewish history. I mean, sitting here talking about Jews going into an oven it has to give you the chills reading a story like this. This story had great meaning for Jews down through the ages, because martyrdom was not, you know, a province of any one period in Jewish history. We had it over and over again. The most obvious being during the time of the Crusades, then moving really not a simultaneous, a little bit earlier even, you had the Almohad conquests in northern Africa. But then as you go forward, you have the Inquisition and the burnings at the stake, the auto da fe, and so on. And then you move to the time of the Cossacks, and 1648-1649. And then you move to the Holocaust and the 20th century, and various pogroms in between, and so on and so forth. But this story has always been very close to the Jewish mind. It's been part of prayer, where we say, may the God who responded to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the fiery furnace, may he answer us as well. That's a standard prayer that's recited at the time of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, as well as on fast days. We don't forget this account. It clearly is mirrored in the story of Abraham. We talked about this already last time, being thrown into the fire by Nimrod, which is a story that children learn about in grade school. They don't understand what they're learning at that point. They don't comprehend the gravity of this of the story. But it's very much a part of Jewish culture, so that anyone who is dealing with the question of should Jews martyr themselves has to deal with this story one way or another. So I brought you two opposite sources, because we had opposing trends in Jewish history going back 1,000 years. In terms of martyrdom, Jews in northern Africa faced the problem when the Almohads, it wasn't just them, but that's the one that I'm bringing right now, when the Almohads managed to conquer large swaths of northern Africa, and Jews who lived there were compelled to accept Islam, at least in name. They would have to make the declaration that Allah was the only God and that Muhammad was his true prophet. How much was required of them in private is unclear. The Rambam, this is the 11th century. The Rambam seems to indicate that it was only the Rambam seems to indicate that it was only that you had to declare loyalty, but that you could do whatever you wanted in private. Unclear. Well, that's part of this story now, because now let me give you a little bit of background. The Rambam's own home of Cordoba, falls to the Almohads in 1148. He, at that point, is 13 years old. His family flees from place to place through the lands of the Crusades, as well as the lands of the Muslims. There are those alleged that he actually, at one point, had to pretend to be a Muslim in order to survive, but I'm not clear on what the basis is for that. His family runs away to Fez in Morocco. His father studies under Rabbi Yehuda HaKohen until Rabbi Yehuda HaKohen is actually killed as a martyr, and then after that, from Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, the great sage of Morocco. Rav Maimon, the Rambam Maimonides' father, wrote a public letter called the Igeret Nechama, Letter of Consolation, in 1160, urging Jews to maintain hope. You can find the Hebrew actually online at a website called benyehuda.org, interestingly. If you remind me, I can email me. I can send you the link. And then, just a couple of years later, the Rambam, Maimonides, writes his own letter to the Jews who felt that they had really lost their stake by having to make this acceptance of Islam. And they had actually received a ruling from some sage who remains anonymous, we don't know his name, who told them that if they were to accept what the Muslims told them to accept, they're as good as dead to Judaism. They shouldn't bother doing any mitzvot because their mitzvot are meaningless. They shouldn't bother to pray because God doesn't want to hear their prayers. Like a really harsh statement. And Maimonides comes out with guns blazing against the fellow who wrote this. I mean, he writes, it's a huge, long letter, of which I brought you a tiny excerpt here. Just a little piece that's most relevant for us. But it's a very worthwhile read. And again, if you email me, I can send you a link where you can find it. But take a look at source number 7.
So this is the Igeret Nechama?
This is the Rambam's letter. Now, Igeret Nechama was his father's letter. This is known usually as either Igeret Hashmad, or I've seen it as Ma'amar al Kiddush Hashem. Sorry?
I want to know where Rambam's family went to
in Africa. Oh, they went to Fez in Morocco. Yeah. And then ultimately, of course, he ends up in Cairo. But in source number 7, he addresses the problem of this story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah going into the furnace to a population that isn't going into the furnace. He says, V'yaduahu, it is known, Mashakara al Yisrael b'mei Nebuchadnezzar harasha, what happened to Israel in the days of wicked Nebuchadnezzar, V'shekomisha haya b'bavel sagad latzalem, that everybody in Babel indeed bowed to the statue, Milvad Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, other than these three men. As God himself said about them in Yeshayah, Jacob should not be ashamed now, his face should not be whitened now. In other words, these are the only three who did not bow. All the other Jews living there did, and God says, let him not be ashamed. Let those people who bowed not be ashamed. So in other words, what he's saying is, yes, it's true, we have these three who I saved from the furnace, right? But you shouldn't look at them and say, well, that's what we are obligated to do, because there were a whole lot of people who bowed who were not considered evil as a result. And he continues, V'ulai, and perhaps, Ha'chereish v'amasger hayu b'chlamisha sagadim hayu az b'bavel. Remember that in the very beginning, when we started this series of classes on Daniel, we learned about the exile of the Jews from Israel to Babylon, and we learned there was a group of sages known as the Chereish and Masger, who actually went first. They were known as the craftsmen and the smiths, and it's understood that they were particularly righteous. So he says, they bowed, assuming they were in Babylon at the time of this story. The chronology is unclear. But he says, V'ulam lo ra'inu me'olam, mi shekera'am lo rasha'im v'lo goyim v'lo psulei edut. We've never seen anybody call them wicked, say that they were no longer Jewish, or that they were invalid as witnesses, which was one of the charges that were made about Jews who indeed bowed. V'lo chashav Hashem yidbarach alayem avon uvdei avodah zarah. God did not assign them guilt as idolaters, Mibnesha Yuanusim, they were forced, they were compelled to do it. Vikach Amru Alehem Shalom, Megillah Yudbet, Hemasu Lefanim, Avani Asay Mahem Lefanim Bimei Haman. The Talmud in Megillah says that they put on an appearance of worshipping idols, so God says, I'm going to put on an appearance of killing them in the days of Haman, until they faked it, I can fake it too. The point is that the Talmud itself recognizes that it wasn't a sincere acceptance of idolatry. It was simply something they were compelled to do. And so too, you should also say, you're not happy about being in this position, but that doesn't mean you're no longer a Jew. It doesn't mean you're no longer a loyal member of the tribe. And so that's his comfort that he offers to the Jews living under the Almohads. Yes?
Well, then God must have been trying to make some point here, because reason these three were told not to bow, pinpointed and said, okay, look, they didn't bow. What are you going to do to the ones who don't bow? Well, I'm going to throw them in the fiery furnace. And God did, yeah, well, I'm going to save them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, like God was trying to make a point.
Right.
They wanted to see what was going on.
Right. So where their decision came from is a good question, that they decided not to bow. But that's precisely the problem. What you're pointing out is precisely the problem. Because the Rambam is making a case for saying, well, you can be okay and still stay part of the tribe. At the same time, you have this account of the three of them. It's here biblically. So who's right? What, you know, are you supposed to bow or are you not supposed to bow? And even the Rambam himself, in his letter, writes, you should get out of there as fast as you can. And if it means losing all your money, you lose all your money. If it means losing members of your family, you lose members of your family. He says, get out of Morocco. You know, get out of these places where you're under session. It wasn't Morocco. I forget where the community was. He was in Morocco, but I don't remember where the community was. Sorry? No, no, he's writing to a community in North Africa. I'm blanking now on which one. But he says, you know, he doesn't want them doing this. He's just saying, you don't give up hope. There's a lot of debate now among Jewish historians as to whether what the Rambam was doing was expressing a law or whether he was simply trying to give encouragement because there was no other option. He knew that he couldn't tell them they have to jump into furnaces. So therefore, he said, let me at least give them courage so that they'll come back once they're able to. That's not at all clear. But what the Rambam said, hold on one second, what the Rambam said ended up being adopted as policy by Spanish Jewry. Sephardic Jewry followed this so that when you get to the time of the Inquisition in Spain, well, Barbanel's day, that's right, you find many Jews who did indeed go to the stake and so on, but many more who became conversos. Because they said, look at what the Rambam said. That philosophy remains with them. Sharon.
I had wanted to ask you if Barbanel wrote about this.
Mm-hmm.
But he would have had to write it, I think, after he left.
Yeah, I mean, well, in general, his commentary on Daniel is written after he's out of Spain anyway, but there's no such thing as being in safety. Right. I don't remember seeing anything from him on Rambam's letter. It's an interesting question. My knowledge of Barbanel is not exhaustive. But his approach in general is to try to provide encouragement for the Jews of his day. That's very much his tack.
Isn't it also like where you're at in your soul and in your heart? So you're bowing, but not in your heart. It's not really, you know, like... very often God says to, so where are you? Like, you know, he says to, so where are you? Like, where are you at in your soul? So I'll go through these motions, who cares? But, and very often, you know, when Hitler came to power, Jews were praying at home and they were keeping Shabbos at home, but outwardly they put on a different show. So
The Germans didn't particularly care how observant somebody was or was not. They were killing everybody.
But a lot of people, when there were these dictators,
right.
they still kept things at home and in their heart.
Within this, the challenge is that, no, we have a tradition that says that I'm not allowed to accept idolatry on the outside as long as it's not what I believe personally. That I'm not supposed to do this. It's considered a desecration of God's name and so on. And this is one of the stories that's quoted in order to say that. Shana.
I'm trying to remember, and unfortunately I can't, but I know that somewhere in the Navi there is a servant in the king's house who is forced
yes.
to bow down, and
yep.
the Vav Rimon, mm-hmm. I can't remember the source, and he talks...
It's Naaman's servant.
Thank you.
Yes.
And he's trying to make tshuva and rectify his position, and he says, but I'll still be this king's servant, and when he bows down to his idol, he's going to pull me down with him,
mm-hmm.
and he's basically told, listen...
Right.
It's okay.
Right. And there's a whole passage in the Talmud where they discuss what his obligations were as a ben Noach, as a Noachite versus as a Jew, and were there Jews present, and would it be Chilul Hashem? Like, it's a whole debate surrounding exactly that question, how he can be told that it is an all right thing for him to do as a servant of the king and as a general. But I want to make sure to get to source number 8, because this is the flip side. Tosfot, remember we've discussed them before, grandchildren of Rashi and their colleagues in France and Germany primarily, Ashkenazim, and architects of Ashkenazi practice as the Rambam is an architect of Sephardic practice. So they're commenting here in source number 8 on a passage in the Talmud that says that being whipped, suffering physical harm, is worse than death. And it says there that had Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah been whipped, they would have bowed to the idol. And Tosfot says, what are you talking about? Tema, I'm shocked, he says. Minalan, how do we know that they would have bowed if they had been tortured? Da'aminan Baharoa, he says, look at the Talmud regarding Rabbi Akiva. Kishotziu was Rabbi Akiva, when they took Rabbi Akiva out to kill him, Omar, he said, Kol yamai ha'isi mitzta'er al pasuk zeh, my whole life, he says, I was pained about this passage. It's the passage in Shema, where you're told to love God b'chol nafshecha, with all of your life. So he says, Emas ayavo liyadi v'akaymenu. I wanted to know, when would I have the opportunity to love God with all of my life, b'chol nafshecha? So that's the end of the quote from Rabbi Akiva. Alma, we learn from here, it sounds like, Mashma de b'chol nafshecha mayri afilu ayumi yasrinas ha'adam b'yisurin kashin dumi ad Rabbi Akiva, shoyim esakin b'sarov b'masrake barzel. The Koshkin Lenagude, he says, look, Rabbi Akiva, we know how he died. The Romans rake his skin with iron combs. They torture him. And yet he says, I am not going to give, I am not going to bend. Right? That's Rabbi Akiva. That's his fulfillment. So how can you tell me that if they would have whipped Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they would have bowed? What, they weren't as righteous as Rabbi Akiva? Is that what you're trying to tell me? Tosfot says, V'omer Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Tam answers, this is familiar from the beginning of our story when we asked what the statue was. The truth is, this statue wasn't an idol. It was a statue in honor of the king. They didn't bow because they wanted to make a point. But under torture, they would have felt, yeah, it's not so important that I make that point. I can make a point in other ways. But what emerges from Tosfot is, if it had been an idol, then no level of torture or force could have made them bow. And that's the stance of the Ashkenazi authorities in the times of the Crusades. And so Ashkenazi communities, you know about the martyrs at York and so on, are burned by the hundreds when the Crusades come through, because they refuse to accept. And that becomes Ashkenazi tradition. So what you have are two traditions going on. Now, I'm oversimplifying by making it Ashkenaz versus Sfard. And I'm oversimplifying by lumping together Muslim persecution and Christian persecution, because they were very different, and what they were expecting of the Jews was very different. So I'm guilty of oversimplifying. What I want to show is that whether you take the approach that Rambam takes here of, even if you bowed, that's not the end of your Judaism, or you take the view of that Tosfo takes here, which is you have to refuse to bow under whatever torture comes, they both have to contend with this story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. It's a formative key event in Jewish history that shapes the way that we look at martyrdom. Rambam will say, yeah, but look at all the ones who did bow. And Tosfot will say, yeah, but they didn't. And it's all a matter of which one you're going to emphasize as your model for popular practice. Yes?
But what about, during the Holocaust, some Jews said they were Christians to get out of
Right, so that's part of the class.
The same thing were wrong.
Right? That's part of the debate. That's part of the debate. Are you allowed to pass as something other than Jewish in order to save yourself? That's exactly where this debate comes into play. So what do we learn from this story? If you take a look at source number 9 quickly, just to make sure we get through this today, so we can at least start next time with chapter 4 for real. Abarbanel sees two major points. I'm going to sum it up, but you can see it here in source number 9. Number 1, he says, this story teaches us the greatness of Daniel. What do you mean? Daniel wasn't here. Yeah, but that's the point. Because Nebuchadnezzar rushes in order to avoid getting Daniel involved. That's why he wants to kill them so quickly, number 1. And number 2, because he sees Daniel in the furnace. He imagines Daniel there in the fiery furnace. So that you see that's how he looked at, that's how much esteem he had for Daniel. That's number 1. And then number 2, the second point that he makes, is that this is meant to give the Jews encouragement in their exile. And here, Sharon, very clearly he's speaking to the Jews of his day who are facing such suffering. And he says, to let them know the malach of God will never leave them and God's supervision will never abandon them, that they will continue to have this hope that the protection that was brought to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah will endure for them. Now, the irony, of course, is that Abarbanel has seen Jews killed, you know, in his own day, and suffering and expelled and so on. So what does it mean when he says, well, God will be with you to protect you? But that's what he sees as the promise in this story. So that concludes for us the story of the statue. What we got through today was the miracle that was done to save Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The question of who the fourth entity in the furnace was. We saw the Talmudic explanation of Gavriel. We saw this Christian approach that Abarbanel rejected. And then we saw Abarbanel's idea that it's the merit of Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar imagines has saved the three of them. We saw as well Nebuchadnezzar's great praise afterwards. And then the question of what happened to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah afterwards. And the impact that this story had, really, on Jewish history. And next time, God willing, we pick up with chapter 4 and the dream of the tree.